Tonight on PBS News Weekend, as Venezuelans prepare to head to the polls, what's at stake in the nation's most consequential presidential election in a decade? Then retailers are rethinking how they set prices as Americans still feel inflation's bite. And how newcomer breaking is bringing more than just sport to the Paris Olympics.
Breaking is not just a culture and a phenomenon, but it's also art. It's art and a sport. So the fusion of both of that is what people are going to see in Paris.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. There are new fears tonight of a wider Middle East conflict after at least 10 children and young adults were killed in a rocket attack on a soccer field in the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights. Israel said Hezbollah militants were responsible, but the group said it struck a military base in retaliation for Israeli attacks on a village in Lebanon. In Gaza, an airstrike hit a school in what had been designated a humanitarian zone. The Israeli military said Hamas used the area to store weapons and plan attacks. Gaza health officials said more than 30 people were killed. Wildfires are devastating communities in the western United States and Canada. In California, the Park Fire north of Sacramento covers 480 square miles. That's about the size of Los Angeles. Hot, windy conditions are pushing it north. Four counties are under evacuation orders, and more than 130 structures have been destroyed. And in Canada, a fast-moving fire has devastated the resort town of Jasper, Alberta, in the Canadian Rockies. It's forced the evacuation of 25,000 people in and around Jasper National Park, which is a World Heritage Site. Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign said today that America's democracy is under assault by former President Donald Trump. It was in response to a speech Trump made to Christian conservatives Friday night. He said that if they elect him in November, they would never have to vote again.
Christians, get out and vote just this time. You won't have to do it anymore. Four more years, you know what? It'll be fixed. It'll be fine.
Late yesterday, the FBI moved to end speculation about this month's assassination attempt on Trump. They said that a bullet, not shrapnel, hit him at that rally in Pennsylvania. At the Olympics, there are fresh concerns about whether the River Seine will be clean enough for competition next week. It played a big part in yesterday's opening ceremony, but the runoff of wastewater from heavy rain has renewed worries about high bacteria levels. The river is to be the venue Tuesday for the swimming leg of the men's triathlon. And Team USA picked up its first gold medal today in the men's 4x100 freestyle swimming relay. The first gold medal overall went to China in the 10-meter air rifle mixed team competition. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, how new technology helps retailers keep the prices shoppers pay in flux, and the art and sport of breaking as it makes its Olympic debut.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
Tomorrow's Venezuelan presidential election could be the most consequential in nearly a decade. Experts say nothing less than the future of Venezuelan democracy could be at stake. The nation's increasingly authoritarian president, Nicolas Maduro, is running to extend his time in the office he assumed in 2013.
If you don't want Venezuela to fall in a bloodshed, let's guarantee the biggest electoral success in the history of our people.
Polls show him trailing challenger Edmundo González Arritia by a large margin. González was an obscure retired diplomat with no political aspirations until a coalition of opposition parties picked him as its candidate.
I want to call on all Venezuelans to join me in a peaceful and orderly change of government.
He has the backing of Maria Corina Machado, the driving force behind the opposition. After winning a primary with more than 90% of the vote, the Maduro government banned her from running.
This moment we are living is the closing of a cycle of chaos to begin an era of order and stability and security.
Together, they've energized voters by promising to reestablish democratic institutions, and end the economic and human rights crises that have led more than 7 million Venezuelans to leave the country over the past 10 years. Many sought refuge in neighboring Colombia and Brazil. Last year, U.S. authorities encountered tens of thousands of Venezuelans along the southern border. If the polls hold true and Maduro does lose, some analysts are skeptical that he would readily accept defeat and give up power. Alexandra Winkler is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She's also a former deputy mayor of El Hatillo, which is one of the five municipalities in Caracas. Why is this election so important? Why is it so crucial and people are watching it so closely?
John, expectations for tomorrow's elections are astronomical because there is so much at stake. It's democracy, it's liberty, it's human rights, it's freedom of association, expression. And I think the most important thing that is on the ballot tomorrow is the reunification of many Venezuelan families who had to be separated because of migration. As we said at the beginning, there's over 7 million Venezuelan migrants already across the world, and people are going to the ballot box tomorrow to bring back their brothers, their sisters, their parents, their kids, because that's what Venezuelans want the most, to be back together as a family in a democratic and progressing nation.
We saw the pictures of the rally in the tape, and also I've read reports of the rallies that particularly Ms. Machado is holding, that she has to sort of sneak in.
Yeah.
What's creating this excitement? What's creating this this enthusiasm?
People, first of all, I think what's different this time is that there is an opposition that is unified under Maria Corina Machado as like the opposition leader, and of course Edmundo Gonzalez, who is our candidate. People trust those opposition leaders. And second, people really want to go to vote tomorrow to make change, to really have their whole voices heard, because they're tired of hyperinflation, they're tired of food scarcity, they're tired of not having water, electricity, they're tired of political persecution of their loved ones. People want change, and I think that's why there's so much excitement towards tomorrow.
You talked about some of those activities that the Maduro government is doing. Late last year, the Maduro government and the opposition signed an agreement to reinstate some democratic institutions, sort of pave the way for free and fair elections tomorrow. What happened to that agreement?
I mean, the fact is that there has been no free and fair elections. Maria Corina Machado was chosen in primaries as the opposition leader, and Maduro did not let her run. She also appointed a successor, Corina Yoris, to also run, and they did not let her run. After negotiations, it was Edmundo González Urrutia. We can't forget that at least of those 8 million, almost 7 million, 8 million migrants that are outside of the country, around four are permitted to vote, and the regime did not allow them to register to vote. So there's 4 million people tomorrow who can vote from the diaspora who can't vote. So these are not free and fair elections, and those conditions have not been respected at all.
Will there be international observers tomorrow?
I mean, there are a couple of international observers, but if you see yesterday, the Maduro regime gave orders to deport different ex-presidents from Mexico, from Bolivia, from Panama, senators from the European Union, from Colombia. People were going to go travel to Venezuela, and the Maduro's regime command was, you know, make sure they get off the plane or don't let that plane kick off, because they don't want the international community to see that they're going to lose tomorrow.
With the skepticism of Maduro, whether Maduro would acknowledge a defeat, what are the range of responses we might see on come Monday morning?
He has shown no indication of wanting to admit defeat, but I think it's going to be very hard to say that he win if polls across Venezuela, nationally and internationally, are giving Maria Corina Machado and Edmundo Gonzalez at least a 25 to 30 point advantage. So it's going to be very hard to actually convince the international community tomorrow that he won if we see massive voters going for Maria Corina Edmundo and just wanting to represent their votes through this change. So
I've seen analysts say that there may have to be negotiations between Maduro and the opposition, or the victors in the election, for him to actually leave office. What are the topics of those negotiations?
Anything that the international community can do or the opposition can do to create incentives for them to go after they lose, I think will always be positive. Of course, there will be conversations after the election, because there will be a six-month period of transition in which we hope that the regime will allow a peaceful and orderly transition in order to reach that democracy when they're sworn into the presidency. So there will continue conversations, but what's going to be very clear is that the opposition is probably going to win tomorrow.
Now, the United States and Venezuela haven't had diplomatic relations since 2019. What are the implications for the United States in this election?
So for the United States in this election, migration's on the ballot. And if we want people to stop fleeing from this country and stop fleeing from all of this disaster, we really need to stop Maduro. So I do think that there is a direct correlation with this election. And if we don't bring Venezuela's prosperity and democracy back, then we will see that migration uptick very quickly.
Alexandra Winkler, thank you very much.
Thank you.
During 3 years of stubborn inflation, many American households cut back on routine purchases at the store. But amid signs that retail prices have started to drop, some companies are rethinking how they decide what to charge. Ellie Rogan has more on the new technology that allows retailers to quickly change prices for items on shelves.
The traditional prices we all see on grocery store shelves may soon be on their way out in favor of what are being called digital shelf labels or electronic shelf labels. They have small digital screens where prices can be updated remotely, sometimes on a daily basis. Consumer advocates worry that this tech could lead to surge pricing, seen already with travel, concert tickets, and car sharing apps like Uber and Lyft. Last month, Walmart announced that by 2026, more than 2,000 of its stores will have digitized shelf labels. The largest retailer in the U.S. is now part of a growing number of companies across the U.S. and Europe using this technology to set prices. Siddharth Kavali is an e-commerce and retail reporter at Reuters. Siddharth, thank you so much for joining us. How do these digital shelf labels work, and how common are they in the United States right now?
The digital shelf labels are basically, they look very much like paper shelf labels, but they're just small digital screens that will reflect the prices. Generally, they use Bluetooth technology so that they can communicate with mobile devices, which can update the prices very easily. So far, the adoption of it in the US is not as rampant. Definitely, Walmart is one of the companies that has gone big with this, introducing them in their stores. Kohl's is another retailer that has been using digital shelf labels since 2015. We also know of Kroger and Instacart testing it now, but we still haven't seen them in stores yet. So we won't see it, at least me and you and regular customer won't see it for the next 2 or 3 years unless you shop regularly at a Walmart.
I should also mention, of course, that this technology is prevalent in parts of Europe right now. But I want to ask you about what retailers say about the benefits of these electric store labels and how those benefits might end up trickling down to customers.
Right. So I'll just talk from the Walmart's perspective. I mean, when they introduced this, they were speaking about how this could help them update prices more easily. Generally, what would take a week for a worker would now just take minutes. And the second benefit of this is that it will replace paper shelf labels. So it will replace waste. And so they said that they could cut back on paper waste by 40%. They also said that this is a very easy technology for them to keep associates abreast of the inventory. And they also want to use it in letting, I guess, workers know how to pick up products for online orders. Nowadays, retailers are using their stores itself as fulfillment centers. Very quickly, an associate can figure out where in the store the product is and can fulfill that order. So there are multiple ways they can use this technology. In fact, sometimes your retailers are using it for displaying QR codes. So for example, if you buy a Heinz ketchup, you don't know if it's gluten-free or allergen-free or the fat content in it. These are things that are not displayed on the label easily. Think of getting a scanned QR code, a QR code right on the digital shelf label where you can just whip out your phone and see all that information easily. So that's another aspect where these digital shelf labels are being used to help the customer.
And I know that Walmart and other stores are arguing that those efficiencies could lead to savings for the customer. But I do want to ask about the flip side of that, which is consumers and advocates are nervous that there might be dynamic pricing employed in which retailers increase prices of items based on demand. How are companies responding to that? And what's the likelihood that that sort of practice is going to take place?
So dynamic pricing is generally legal in the US. And any retailer is able to do it if they want to. But generally, because of the backlash about against surge pricing, Walmart said that they would not be using it for surge pricing. If they would be using it, it would be mostly to cut prices or to offer promotions or to display promotions and discounts. And so consumer advocates, there is concern that there could be, they could always raise prices. And this has happened in the past. For example, Coca-Cola in the 90s tried to introduce a vending machine where they would raise prices when the weather was really hot, and that faced a lot of backlash, and they just shut that program. So there's a lot of scrutiny on price right now. And surge pricing at the grocery store, especially prices of grocery stores, it'll be really hard for retailers to get away with it.
Why are these efforts being employed now? As we mentioned, they've already been the norm in parts of Europe and indeed parts of the United States for a while. Is this just the pace of modernization, or are these efforts by retailers to address inflation concerns, or a combination of the two?
Most of it is retailers are trying to upgrade their stores by using automation. They're trying to use, you know, brighter materials, like, for example, LEDs. And now they're moving towards digital shelf labels. So I would say that one part of this is definitely modernization. The other part is also, yes, this also helps with addressing inflation concerns. When they do get digital price labels, what will happen is they will be able to like update prices to market conditions more easily, and there won't be that lag between what the market says and what you can actually put in the store. It also helps you with managing your inventory levels much better, especially at times when there is low demand and you want to sell products more quickly. Think about a milk carton that is getting, you know, that is expiring within 2 days. You want it out of your store quickly. So in such instances, you can maybe cut the price by half so people can like buy it more quickly. So there are ways in which they can, you know, address, you can bring in inflationary pressures down on their business, and they can also reduce costs. So for example, when I mentioned earlier that the paper shelf tags were a big environmental issue and a big cost for them, by replacing the paper shelf tags with digital shelf tags, they could reinvest the savings back into price.
Siddharth Kavali with Reuters, thank you so much for breaking this down for us.
Thank you for having me.
In about 2 weeks at the Paris Olympics, the debut of an entirely new medal event, breaking, or what's perhaps more widely known to the uninitiated like me, as breakdancing. In a Los Angeles dance studio, 21-year-old Logan Edra teaches moves she spent two-thirds of her life developing since she was just 7. In the world of breaking, she's called B-Girl Logistics. And as one of the 4 members of the U.S. breaking team at the Paris Games, she can also be called Olympian.
I see any title or championship or win or medal, it's more for me like a microphone to amplify any message I want. I represent the peace, love, unity, and having fun, and also being a student of the game and caring about the evolution of like where this is going and keeping it alive.
The first Olympic breaking competition was at the 2018 Youth Games in Buenos Aires. The Olympics recognizes it as an urban sport, like skateboarding, also an Olympic event. Competitors need improvisation, athleticism, and coordination, drawing on disciplines like martial arts and gymnastics. It was created in the 1970s at South Bronx dance parties by Black and Latino youths. It's said that the name comes from the breaks in hip-hop songs, when the vocals drop out, leaving a steady driving beat. The 1983 film Flashdance helped breaking go mainstream with a scene with members of the hip-hop group Rocksteady Crew. Now its popularity is global. From the United Kingdom to France.
If you think about Paris, maybe you think about the Eiffel Tower and you think about croissants, but when I think about Paris, I think about raw hip-hop.
Nigeria. Egypt.
Dancing is what makes you stay away from smoking and drinking and all of the self-destructive things. For me, it's an art, but also something that I find myself in.
Brazil, Libya, even Iran.
Here is Iran, and we are dancing. We love to dance as other people do. We want to enjoy our youth.
What was born at block parties of the Bronx will be going for the gold at the Place de la Concorde in the heart of Paris. Ivan Velez, known as Flips, is an actor, TV host, an accomplished dancer and choreographer, and he's been a judge at Olympic qualifying events for breaking. So Flips, first off, help out this unhip baby boomer. Breaking, breakdancing.
So we call it breaking. If you accidentally call it breakdancing, we'll let you slide on the first time. It was more of a media term that came out in the early 80s, but I do understand why people call it breakdancing, because they are breaking and it is a dance. However, we call it breaking.
So what's the significance of having breaking as an Olympic event?
Oh, it is the epitome. I know in 2018, it was in Buenos Aires, and it was the first whiff that we got that we could actually hit the main stage. Breaking is finally where it needs to be, going for gold.
Finally where it needs to be. Is it is it a dance style? Is it a culture?
Oh, to go beyond that, for me, it's like a religion. So you have to believe in yourself. You have to believe in your talent. You have to go above and beyond the call of duty just to be recognized. So a lot of these breakers, whether they have jobs 9 to 5, whether they're in school, no matter what age they are putting in endless, endless hours. And breaking is not just a culture and a phenomenon, but it's also art. It's art and a sport. So the fusion of both of that is what people are going to see in Paris, almost like a Halley's Comet. You got to catch it while you can.
You're not going to be judging in Paris, I know, but you did judge some of the qualifying events. What's the criteria? Yeah. How do you judge this?
There's a couple of criteria and boxes that they have to tick. It's technique, right? So it's how the technique is how good you are at doing everything that you've been training to do. You have to definitely put years in the game or your technique will show. The vocabulary. Vocabulary is what you bring to the table. There's A's to Z's, top rock, footwork, freezes, power, combinations. And what you bring to the table is your vocabulary and how many times you can switch things up. You have originality, right? So you want to be the one and only. And in order to do that, you have to stand alone. You have to be unique and you have to show as many original moves as you have learned in the past. You only have 60 seconds before your opponent also answers back. So you definitely want to execute from the very first second you step on that floor to the end of that 59.9 second and you're walking off. Also musicality. I love musicality and I'll tell you why. We are dancers, right? So it's all framed around the music. If you don't have musicality and you're dancing with either two left feet or you're off beat, we're definitely going to ding you for that. You definitely have to dance and marry the beat and the music that these DJs are playing. You don't know the BPMs. You don't know what track. You don't know if there's lyrics to the track. So it's a really cool game of cat and mouse.
Tell us a little bit about the Team USA breakers.
Oh, yeah, definitely Team USA all day. You have Victor Montalvo, who made it. He's half Mexican, half U.S., he's from Florida, and he's the highest ranked in the entire world. And we have Sunny Choi, who made it. She's from New York. She had a full-time job, six-figure salary, and she's given it all up for the gold. We also have Logistics, who I met years ago. I worked with her on a Nickelodeon show. She was a kid. A few years later, she was on World of Dance, and now she's on the world's biggest stage in the Olympics. B-Boy Jeffro. He's one of the all-style, all-around, can throw anything down, and his musicality, which, again, I love, is so on point. It's going to be a nail-biting couple of days, I'll tell you that.
Flips, I know that breaking has not been approved for the 2028 Los Angeles Games. What do you see the future of this? Where do you want to see this go?
So with that news, sadly, it was not accepted for the 2028. And what better way to bring it back, right, to the U.S. where it all started? Hopefully it's in Brisbane in 2032. I'm praying for that right now because you don't want too much time to go by. As these dancers are evolving, they're also getting older. So the future looks really, really bright for breaking. And you might not see these same competitors again in that next cycle if it is another 8 years. I do want breaking to just stay on the roster. I mean, it's survived 50 years, you know, whether it was on in the media or in the movies or underground culture or subculture, it's survived. It's definitely ready to earn its slot, permanent slot.
Flips, a.k.a. Ivan Velez, thank you very much.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I'm excited.
And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.